Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the G7 nations meeting in Italy to find a unified approach to pressure Russia to distance itself from Syria's Assad regime following its use of chemical weapons on children. Nada Hashemi, the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the University of Denver and author of the new book Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East, joins us to discuss his latest article at CNN, Obama's Syria Mistake is Now Trump's Problem. We will assess whether Assad's latest atrocity has brought the Syrian conflict back onto the front burner after it appeared that the fall of Aleppo meant that Assad, the Russians and Iranians had won the war and that the U.S. was prepared to accept that reality and go along with the Russian plan to keep Assad in power as this war that has destroyed Syria enters its seventh year. Then we'll look into the Rose Garden ceremony today, where Judge Gorsuch was sworn in amid sunny smiles and spring flowers as the president, Senator McConnell, and Senator Grassley celebrated a great victory for which Judge Gorsuch thanked them without any mention that the seat was stolen from Judge Garland and that the U.S. Senate was blown up in order to get Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. Elizabeth Wydra, president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, joins us to discuss the important cases before the court that Gorsuch will now rule on. Then finally, we will speak with Josh Gerstein, who is a senior White House reporter at Politico, about his latest article at Politico, New Suit Demands Trump White House Visitor Logs, and discuss how what used to be public information is kept under wraps by the new administration so that the identity of Trump's visitors to the White House, Trump Tower, and Mar-a-Lago remain secret. We will also examine how being a member of Trump's private club in Florida has its benefits, with the Koch brothers enjoying a tableside chat with Trump as a perk that goes along with William Koch's $200,000 annual membership of Mar-a-Lago. And joining us now is Nada Hashemi, who is the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School for International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. His latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. And he has an article at CNN, Obama's Syria Mistake is Now Trump's Problem. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nada Hashemi.
Thanks, Ian.
And the G7 foreign ministers are meeting in Italy as we speak to pressure Russia to distance itself from Bashar al-Assad. Obviously, Russia brokered the removal of chemical weapons after the 2013 red line was crossed and President Obama backed down from his threat to punish Syria for using chemical weapons that killed 1,400 people in the Damascus suburbs. But since Donald Trump has responded to the pictures of the children dying from sarin gas, obviously the equation has changed a little bit. But do you think, given Russia's denials and Syria's denials about the use of chemical weapons and the possibility that Russian troops on the ground actually were present when these chemical weapons were loaded on the Syrian warplanes, are they ever going to accept responsibility, do you think, and own up to what's going on?
Well, I don't think so, but let me just correct some of the assumptions in your question. I don't believe it was the sight of, you know, children that motivated Donald Trump. I think, you know, this was largely for internal reasons to deflect from his own internal crises. But the broader point that you're raising with respect to accountability of Russian support for Syrian war crimes, I think the answer to the question is pretty clear, and that's a unequivocal no. I mean, Vladimir Putin himself is no paragon of moral virtue when it comes to human rights, and particularly when it comes to accountability for war crimes, given his own role in Chechnya when he was, you know, that's really where he made his name in presiding over a series of war crimes in the late 1990s. But I am very much supporting and welcoming this greater global focus on what's happening in Syria, Russia's role in Syria, and the fact that now Russia is being asked to explain its own particular role and knowledge with respect to the recent chemical weapons attack in Idlib province. I think those are all positive developments because of the sheer, you know, mass politicide that has taken place in Syria over the last 6 years. We're talking about almost 500,000 deaths, overwhelmingly, you know, children, the biggest refugee crisis since World War II, a torture crisis, an underreported rape crisis, and a moral and humanitarian catastrophe that, you know, we have rarely seen. So, you know, these, and what's I think important about this is that literally a week ago, the position that the Trump administration had was the position that many people had, you know, in Western capitals. And that was, well, the war is over. We have to basically accept Bashar al-Assad's conquest of most of Syria. He's the winner, and we just have to accept that reality. And so I'm glad now that there is at least an attempt to push back against that fait accompli.
But I thought back in 2013, the Russian brokered deal to get rid of Syria's stockpiles of chemical weapons, I think it was done under the auspices of the UN, and that Russia was the guarantor. Well, clearly, not all of the weapons were rounded up.
Well, absolutely. And so I think it highlights not just Russia's own failure to live up to its part of the deal. They were supposed to be the guarantor to make sure that their client state and the figure of Bashar al-Assad lived up to the terms of the agreement. I just saw a report today published by the Syrian American Medical Society that documented over 160 different uses of chemical weapons during the course of the Syrian war, many of those instances after this agreement was allegedly signed. But I think the other part of the story here, Ian, that I'd like to draw your listeners to is a very important article that appeared in yesterday's New York Times by Peter Baker, where he also drew attention to President Obama's policy with respect to Syria and how now it's clearly, I think, a colossal failure. Because one of the things that President Obama kept touting is that, well, we weren't able to do anything about the massive war crimes and the displacement and the human suffering in Syria. Right up until his last day in power, you know, Obama and his advisors kept saying, well, at least we were able to remove chemical weapons from Syria. That is sort of a minor success. But we're seeing clearly now that that's not a success, that it's become an international crisis. And I think the broader lesson here that needs to be learned is that when you make deals with authoritarian regimes, when you put your trust in political tyrannies, it always comes back to haunt you.
And again, I'm speaking with Nada Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement, The Struggle for Iran's Future, and The Syria Dilemma. And his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East. And he has an article at CNN, Obama's Syria Mistake is Now Trump's Problem. And of course, the Syrian civil war is now entering its seventh year. It has produced the greatest mass displacement of people since World War II. Nearly half of Syria's 23 million people have fled their homes. And I recall that when Russia intervened and put boots on the ground and aircraft in September 2015, shortly thereafter, there was a mass exodus of refugees. And the assumption has to be that people don't get out of Syria, particularly in these besieged enclaves where they're being starved to death, unless Assad lets them out. And it always struck me as being obvious that there was complicity there between the Russians and the Syrians to flood Europe with refugees. And the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe at the time, General Breedlove, accused Putin of weaponizing refugees. So is that a card that Putin can still play?
Well, I suspect he's really played that card to its maximum utility, in the sense that I think most people that have been able to flee Syria have fled. There's officially 5 million UN refugees, about 6.3 million internally displaced. And you're right. I mean, as I mentioned in my CNN article, that one of the important, I think, under-recognized aspects of the war in Syria, that it's not just a Syria problem, it's not just a Middle East problem, it's truly a global problem, because that massive wave of refugees, particularly in 2015, about half a million Syrian refugees tried to get into Europe, that massive wave of people fleeing for safer territory had hugely destabilizing effects in terms of European politics. It led to the rise of right-wing populist parties. It contributed, I would argue, significantly to the Brexit vote and the possible disintegration of the entire European Union, as we're seeing right now. It also had an effect, and this is where it's so ironic with respect to Obama's policy, it also had an effect on U.S. Domestic politics, because, as most of your listeners will recall, Donald Trump was able to, I think, successfully invoke the fear of Syrian refugees coming into the United States the acts of terrorism that took place in Paris and Brussels, which were directly connected to the conflict in Syria, as a way of invoking the fear of terrorism to rally people around a particular fear narrative. And so the irony of, I think, Obama's policy towards Syria is that he argued in 2013 that, look, you know, what happens in Syria could be contained. It really wouldn't affect core U.S. national interests. Well, I think that was arguably the biggest foreign policy miscalculation of his presidency, because not only did it deeply destabilize the Middle East, not only did it destabilize Europe, but it also, I would argue, had a indirect but serious and significant effect on the rise in the election of Donald Trump, the defeat of Hillary Clinton, and really the ending of President Obama's own legacy that he was hoping to pass on to Hillary Clinton. That's all behind us now. So I think as we do the assessments and we look back on that fateful decision in 2013 when there was that massive chemical weapons use on the outskirts of Damascus, and President Obama sort of, you know, threatened that he was going to strike militarily, but then struck this, you know, Russian brokered chemical weapons deal, hoping that that will sort of diminish the level of conflict in Syria and not really affect the United States in any significant way. Well, clearly it has, because now, again, the whole world is talking about it. Now we have this extremist president that's in power in part because of the exploitation of fears of terrorism and immigration. And, you know, we're sort of back at square one in terms of trying to figure out what to do about the conflict in Syria. It certainly is not over.
So do you think, though, the narrative and the policy has changed with the Trump administration? I mean, it's worth noting today in the city of Lucca in Tuscany, where the conference of the G7 nations foreign ministers are meeting to pressure Russia to basically deal with Assad and particularly the chemical weapons issue. Before the meeting on Monday, Secretary of State Tillerson took part in a wreath-laying ceremony to remember those killed by in a Nazi massacre of villages in 1944, and Tillerson drew parallels with what just happened in Syria with the chemical attack, saying, quote, "We rededicate ourselves to holding to account any and all who commit crimes against the innocents anywhere in the world." Now, that is very different from what Tillerson said about a week earlier, where he said it was up to the Syrian people to decide Assad's fate, which was a callous and stupid remark, because how could, you know, half a population either internally displaced or in camps or in Europe, how could they even vote? And what would vote mean? None of the voting in Syria has ever meant anything. I mean,
right.
One thing that Syrians tell me is that the only time you open your mouth in Syria is when you go to the dentist. The place has been run by these 17 different security services. It's the most Stalinist country on the face of the planet, probably. And it's just horrible that they were about to sell out everything, and now they've totally done 180 degrees. And I wonder if you can trust these people in the White House.
Well, I don't think you can. It's pretty clear if they can switch policy 180 degrees so quickly, it raises sort of serious questions about whether there is any serious sort of not just ethical core, but whether there's a grand strategy or plan for solving any international or domestic problem. But you're absolutely right when Tillerson sort of said roughly a week ago that, you know, the future of Assad will be determined by the Syrian people. That was just code word for saying Assad is there to stay and we're going to accept it. Now, Tillerson, over the last couple of days, and today in Europe, is drawing analogies between sort of, you know, war crimes in World War II and what just happened in Idlib province a few days ago. So I think that suggests that there has been, at least in one part of the Trump administration, a shift. There's an attempt clearly to, I think, hold Russia accountable for its support for the Assad regime. And I suggest what's happening is they want to sort of use the chemical weapons attack, the atrocities that have taken place really for the last 6 years, but particularly in this dramatic form last week, to sort of, I think, hold Russia accountable, to try and sort of put them on the hot spot, shine a global spotlight as a way of forcing them to take a stand with respect to the future of Syria. Either they're going to continue to back Assad, or they're going to try and figure out some way to contribute to some negotiated settlement that will get Russia to play a more constructive role in terms of the future of Syria. So it's pretty clear that there is a shift going on with respect to Trump's policy. Of course, this has nothing to do with Trump. I suspect that he couldn't identify Syria on the map if his life depended on it. But with respect to his foreign policy advisors, particularly, you know, Tillerson, but also Nikki Haley at the UN, they're talking a much tougher language. And the big question here is, well, what is the, you know, grand strategy? We're hearing different things literally within the last week. And it seems now that there is a shift with respect to the future of Assad. No longer is there a willingness, I think, on the part of the Trump administration to sort of allow Assad to stay in power and to continue to rule. I think they want him out at some point. How they're going to get him out and what role Russia will play in helping to remove Assad from power in the context of a broader political settlement, I think that remains to be seen. And what also remains to be seen is the broader Trump strategy, which is, I think, really, you know, unfolding as we watch these events take place.
Well, I think that, you know, there are obviously lots of parallels or connections between Trump and Putin. And, of course, there's a lot of inquiries going on to the extent to which Putin helped elect Trump. But in terms of their governing style, they both use unpredictability and confusion. And this is the textbook of Vyacheslav Surikov, who's Putin's advisor, who Bannon has borrowed a lot of his tactics from. Putin does a bread and circus distraction by starting wars to distract people from the extent to which him and his cronies are stealing Russia blind. I'm not accusing Trump yet of starting wars, but he might well do. But he definitely governs by stunt, by public relations stunts. There's no substance to what he's doing. And I think the same is true of Putin. And everything that Putin's done actually has been a catastrophe. The Crimea is costing them a fortune. The war in Ukraine, all that's done is motivate the Ukrainians now to stand up to Russia even more. And they're not going to bow down anymore. Probably the same is true of the other Eastern European countries, except for Belarus. So, and I think he and the Iranians could be absolutely stuck with the bill in Syria if the West plays it right. And that's what's mystifying about this conference that took place at the time when Syria was using poison gas. There was a meeting in Brussels headed by the EU foreign minister, the former Italian foreign minister, and she, of course, is a friend of Putin's, and I'm not quite sure where she's coming from. But they met,
right.
They got a pledge of about, I don't know how many billions, it's a little difficult to find out how much was pledged, but then the chemical attack came and it sort of blew up in their face. So I'm astounded that anybody in the West would want to pay for the reconstruction of Syria, handing it over to Assad when he's the world's biggest war criminal. So why not dump this whole mess, this reconstruction bill, on the Russians and the Iranians? They're the ones who kept this guy in power. They should pick up the tab.
Well, correct. None of them have economies that I think that can sustain a reconstruction effort. So that's a non-starter. And in terms of the conference that you mentioned, no one in the rest of the international community is going to put any money into Syria to support a regime that's run by a war criminal. So that's a complete non-starter. I think there's a lot of confusion. I think we're in many ways back to square one, and the ball really now is in the court of the Trump administration to see whether they can do anything constructively about Syria. I don't think they can. I don't think they can do anything constructively about anything. But now the ball in many ways is in their court. I think Trump has benefited from this Tomahawk missile strike, which I think largely was motivated, in my reading, as a publicity stunt to get him some good press coverage after, you know, several weeks of bad press coverage. But, you know, now there's a sense that I think some of the more, let's say, more pragmatic foreign policy advisors in Trump's inner circle, particularly H.R. McMaster and less so Steve Bannon, are assuming, I think, greater say here in terms of the running of U.S. foreign policy. There's a sense that this America first, a sort of hyper-nationalism where we break away from the world, is not going to lead anywhere, and that if you want to do anything about global problems such as Syria, you have to work with the international community, particularly if you want their support in terms of getting Assad out of power, financing the reconstruction, reducing the level of violence. That's not something that the United States can do alone. And so if you, you know, start from that premise, that demands international engagement, diplomacy, some sort of vision. I don't think Trump has it within his capacity. I don't know if his foreign policy advisors have it to sort of do what's needed to lead on Syria. And so I'm very pessimistic, actually, Ian, in terms of where this is going to lead. I think it's largely going to be motivated by getting some good press coverage, perhaps demonstrating that, you know, the United States tried to do something, but in the end it was just too complicated and we'll just have to, you know, leave it as it is. So I think that's really where we're headed. I hope I'm wrong, but I am fundamentally happy that at least now the global spotlight is back on Syria. The assumption that after Aleppo fell, that we just had to accept the Russian, Iranian, and Bashar al-Assad's conquest of Syria and just sort of, you know, accept the fact that, you know, a mass politicized had taken place and there's nothing that the world can do about it, that assumption no longer holds, and now there's significant pushback. So I think, if, you know, in that limited sense, I think something positive has come out of these recent developments.
Well, Nader Hashemi, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I'm speaking with Nader Hashemi, who's the director of the Center for Middle East Studies at the Joseph Corbell School of International Studies at the University of Denver. He's the author of The People Reloaded, The Green Movement and the Struggle for Iran's Future, The Syrian Dilemma, and his latest book is Sectarianization, Mapping the New Politics of the Middle East, and he has an article at CNN, Obama's Syria Mistake is Now Trump's Problem. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to the Rose Garden ceremony where Judge Gorsuch was sworn in amid sunny smiles and spring flowers without any mention that his seat was stolen from Judge Garland and that the U.S. Senate was blown up in order to get Gorsuch on the Supreme Court.
اكتب وخط بالقلم دموع من عيني دموع من عيني يا ناس مالي حدا يا ناس مالي حدا بهمي وعسيني
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Elizabeth. And there was a very sunny, a lovely spring day in Washington in the Rose Garden today where Justice Gorsuch was sworn in by his mentor, the Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. And President Trump, of course, was beaming there, almost like a proud father. He couldn't help resisting taking credit or talking, making the conversation about him. By saying, I got it done in the first 100 days. You think that's easy? But in general, there was no irony there about from all of them, you know, praising Senator McConnell as Gorsuch did and everybody else who helped him and all the people who got him there. There was no mention of how he got there at the expense of Justice Garland.
Yes, it certainly reminded me on this sunny spring day of another sunny, lovely day in the Rose Garden, which I happened to have the honor of being there for, and that was when President Obama announced his nomination of Chief Judge Merrick Garland for this very seat that Justice Gorsuch just took today. And I think that it's impossible to talk about this confirmation without recognizing that context, because it makes the Supreme Court a political issue in a way that it really hasn't been before, because right now we're talking about a Republican Senate that broke the rules in order to get this extremely conservative nominee through after Senator McConnell refused to consider for nearly a year the nomination of President Obama's Supreme Court nominee. So I think it's impossible to exclude Merrick Garland from this history, even though the White House, Justice Gorsuch, and the Senate Republicans have certainly tried their best to have amnesia about the months and months and months that Merrick Garland's nomination languished in the Senate.
So do you think in any way that Associate Justice of the Supreme Court now, Neil Gorsuch, feels any sense of disquiet or even shame? I mean, not only is he in a stolen seat, and he got there at the expense of Merrick Garland, to get there, the United States Senate had to blow up. And many, many senators felt that crossing the line, as Mitch McConnell did with the nuclear option, was something that they would rue, and many lamented that the Senate had become something that was almost unrecognizable. So a lot of damage done. And do you think this man in any way recognizes that he's the beneficiary at a great cost?
I don't know what he personally thinks about it. You know, at his hearings, he certainly seemed to, and in private meetings beforehand, apparently recognized that Judge Garland is a well-respected person, and expressed some regret for the way he was treated. But I don't think he regrets the fact that now Gorsuch himself gets the seat. I think one person that we should be thinking about how he feels about all this is Chief Justice John Roberts, who has said repeatedly that he doesn't like the impression that the justices on the court are Democrats or Republicans. He has said that he doesn't want the American people to think of the court that way, as a political body, just like Congress or the president. But this process certainly does make the Supreme Court seem much more like a political body, just like Congress or the White House. And so I think Chief Justice Roberts, while he, as a conservative, is probably happy to have Justice Gorsuch, another conservative, on the bench, he should be very upset by the way that this process, and Mitch McConnell more than anyone else, has injected politics into this. I think another way that Chief Justice Roberts should not be happy with how this has gone is the fact that Donald Trump, and he talked today about how he, you know, did this within the first 100 days. Well, he made a lot of campaign promises about the Supreme Court, and he explicitly had litmus tests for the kind of justice that he promised his supporters he would put on the bench. And that's something that, while Gorsuch himself at his hearings tried to say that he wasn't proposed these litmus tests explicitly by Donald Trump himself, clearly in the process to select a nominee whose name got on the list, one can only assume that they looked at these particular tests. And those, as stated by Donald Trump, were someone who would automatically, in Donald Trump's words, overturn Roe versus Wade, the right to choose an abortion, someone who would rule in favor of gun rights, and someone who would look favorably on evangelical Christian religious liberty claims. And that's something that's problematic because we don't normally think of justices having to pass tests. They're supposed to take the cases as they come, you know, with a certain ideology that's understandable. This is obviously going to be someone more conservative than not, but someone who will not guarantee a vote in a particular way. And I think while Judge Gorsuch tried to distance himself from that at his hearing, that's undeniably the context in which his nomination arose.
And again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who is the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. Well, in terms of Justice Gorsuch getting to where he is, it was obviously very important that he got on that list of 21 names that basically Trump himself was given, and it was put together by the Federalist Society, and he wasn't on the first list, but on the second list. I spoke recently with the lawyer for the so-called frozen trucker, who had a terrible choice: either you freeze to death or you go and seek shelter, and as a consequence, you lose your job. Six of the seven judges that looked at that case ruled in the trucker's favor, but Neil Gorsuch ruled for the corporation. The lawyer for the frozen trucker argued that Neil Gorsuch was in fact auditioning for the Federalist Society and the Heritage Foundation to get on that list with that vote. I don't know how that can be proven one way or the other, but what is the story with the fact that Gorsuch was first approached by the Federalist Society about the list, not by Trump himself?
You know, he's very much an establishment, deeply rooted conservative lawyer and then jurist. he was involved in, you know, Washington conservative circles. So, you know, there was, I think, a lot of effort to portray him as sort of this, you know, Westerner outside the Washington elite. He very much is of the conservative elite. And I think that's exactly why you had people like the Federalist Society and Heritage Foundation putting forth his name. There are a lot of things about his record that check important boxes for very, very conservative Republicans and very conservative libertarians. He has been very focused on protecting religious claims over the rights of third parties. The most important example of that is when he sided with the religious organizations that were preventing women employees from accessing contraception coverage to which they are entitled under the Affordable Care Act. He would have gone even further than the Supreme Court eventually did in their particular case. That's the Hobby Lobby case and then the later Little Sisters of the Poor case, which are incredibly important. Also, he has, as you noted, with the frozen trucker case, which, you know, that is a, I think you talked about the real choice that this man was put to in terms of, does he operate his vehicle in an unsafe manner? That is, does he either stay with it and potentially freeze to death, or does he drive it in a way that's unsafe, which he, you know, it was a difficult position that he was put in. And Judge Gorsuch, when he was on the bench, bent the law in a way that I think was not an accurate reading of the text of the statute in order to find for the employer. And that's the thing that is problematic when you look at his record and the reason that my organization, Constitutional Accountability Center, ultimately opposed his nomination, because it seemed as if he was reading the law in a way that would bend it to rule for corporations in cases instead of, you know, the average American worker. And you want a justice who is going to apply the law impartially and fairly for all and not be beholden to particular corporate interests, other special interests, or putting forth a political agenda of his own or that of the president who nominated him. So certainly, I hope I'm wrong about that. You know, I'd love for him to get on the bench, and as someone who litigates in front of the Supreme Court, I will be making my best arguments to him, and I certainly hope he will follow the law where it leads, including when it leads to progressive outcomes. But there is a lot to be concerned about from his record and very much from the way in which his name was put on the list and the people who were putting together that list and the fact that Donald Trump is the president who chose him. This is one of the most authoritarian, anti-constitutional presidents we've ever seen. I don't know if we've ever seen quite his like. And so the fact that Donald Trump chose him, that he could be Trump's justice, is something that we should all be keeping an eye on and, frankly, be very concerned about.
Well, is it therefore an irony then, Elizabeth Wydra, that in the Rose Garden ceremony today, Justice Anthony Kennedy, in swearing in Gorsuch, this was the second oath that he took, to impartially interpret the law, quoting the oath, and do equal right to the poor and to the rich?
Look, I hope that he very much makes good on that oath. I hope that he gets to the bench and surprises many of us who are skeptical by being someone who does follow the Constitution and the law where it leads. But, you know, the burden is on him, frankly, especially after the way that we saw Donald Trump repeatedly criticize judges who ruled in ways that he didn't like. You know, we saw that after the judges on the lower courts rightfully blocked Trump's unconstitutional Muslim ban, travel refugee ban. We've seen that in the Trump University cases where Trump's vision of an ideal judge seems to be a judge that rules in Trump's favor. So the burden is on Justice Gorsuch to show that he is going to be that independent, impartial justice, which he pledged to be. And I certainly hope he is. Those are certainly the right things to say. And the proof will be in the pudding when he actually starts issuing decisions from the Supreme Court bench.
Well, just to follow up on the extent to which Judge Gorsuch may have auditioned for the Federal Society and the Heritage Foundation in getting on the list to be picked for the Supreme Court. During his confirmation, Gorsuch said that he was first contacted about his candidacy for the Supreme Court, not by the White House, but by Leonard Leo, who's a high-ranking Federalist Society official. Let's then, if we can, just in the last few minutes, Elizabeth Wydra, go through some of the cases that Gorsuch will be ruling on. Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Comer, a Missouri church denied state funding for a playground in a case concerning separation of church and state. Do you think that's a significant one?
Yes, that case has been delayed in its scheduling by the court. They could have easily heard it before Judge Gorsuch became Justice Gorsuch, but clearly they thought that there was a likelihood that they might split 4-4, and therefore there is every indication that Justice Gorsuch's vote could be the deciding vote in that case. And that case is about a state constitutional provision that put some distance between church and state when it comes to funding. So this is a real test of how Justice Gorsuch will work to break down that church-state wall. There are also really important cases that are in the process of being considered by the Supreme Court, what we call petitions for certiorari. That's whether the Supreme Court is going to take them up in the first place. And there are important cases involving gun rights. There's a case out of California about the supposed right to have a handgun outside the home and Second Amendment issues there. There are also important cases about voting rights. There's an appeal from a North Carolina decision that talked about how the North Carolina legislature used surgical precision, those were the words of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in targeting the rights of people of color to vote in that state. That's an incredibly important issue coming up. And there's also another religious liberty case that's on the doorstep of the Supreme Court, a cake baker who refused, based on purported religious objections, to bake a cake for a gay couple who was getting married. So there are these important fundamental rights issues that Justice Gorsuch will be weighing in on in the next few weeks and months. So we won't have to wait long to really see how he is going to cast his votes in these crucial cases. We might have to wait a little bit longer to see whether he will make good on Donald Trump's promise to put someone on the bench who will overturn Roe versus Wade, but we won't have to wait very long to see Justice Gorsuch's impact.
And just to quickly go through these cases, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, that's a Colorado baker who refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Peralta versus San Diego, does the Second Amendment grant California gun owners the right to carry a concealed weapon in public places? North Carolina versus North Carolina NAACP, North Carolina voting overhaul that's said to target African Americans with almost surgical precision. And then there's another case which I'd like you to comment on, that's Hernandez versus Mesa. That's the case of a 15-year-old Mexican who was on the Mexican side of the border when he was shot dead in 2010 by a U.S. Border Patrol agent. Surely that one will be watched closely because of Donald Trump's wall and, in general, his support for the Border Patrol and for getting tough on the border.
Yes, that case is very important generally, but also I think, as you correctly noted, as Donald Trump encourages more deportation forces to really be rather rough with their enforcement activities and expanding his idea of who really should be targeted for removal from this country, even people who are contributing to communities in important ways here in the United States. That case has already been argued, but if it looks like there could be a 4-4 split, then they could set that case for re-argument with Justice Gorsuch participating so he could be the tie-breaking vote. So we'll just have to see in that one whether it'll be one that they decide without Justice Gorsuch or whether they re-argue it and have him to weigh in on that case.
Well, Elizabeth Wydra, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure to be with you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. And again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the president of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. We're going to take a brief station break, back looking into a lawsuit asking for the visitors' logs to the White House, Trump Tower, and Mar-a-Lago be made public again. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Josh Gerstein, who is a senior White House reporter for Politico, specializing in legal and national security affairs. Previously, he was a reporter at the New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News, and part of CNN's investigative unit. He has an article at Politico, New Suit Demands Trump White House Visitor Logs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Josh Gerstein.
Hey, Ian. Good to be with you.
Thanks, Josh. And what are we to make of this friendly chat that took place at Mar-a-Lago Resort in Palm Beach on Saturday night, where one of the members of the club, Bill Koch, the lesser known of the Koch brothers, who has obviously paid his $200,000 annual membership, was dining with his brother, Charles Koch. And also at the table was the conservative media entrepreneur, Chris Ruddy, who's a close friend of the president's and also a member of Mar-a-Lago Club. And the fact that this is being reported by you and Politico goes against what the Trump administration appears to be doing, which is not making visitor logs to the White House, Mar-a-Lago, or Trump Tower available as predecessors had.
Right. So the Secret Service, in fact, has told us that they don't really have a list of logs. I mean, it's a very strange situation, what's going on there at Mar-a-Lago in terms of any prior precedent in recent history, to have a facility that's sort of run by or owned by the president, to which private members belong and they saunter in and out. They may or may not have an appointment even with the president, but next thing you know, he's there and meeting with them. At the same time, it's not really open to the public. So it's a curious situation. You know, we did have a resolution of this under the Obama administration. For the first time, they agreed to make regular disclosures of visitors to the White House. There had been litigation on that point, and they decided to do that. They were not 100% complete. They occasionally did withhold information, and there's obviously always ways to get around them to meet people off the complex and what have you. But they agreed to do that, and over the course of the 8 years of the Obama administration, they released close to 6 million records of visitors to the White House. And so that was the precedent that was set. It is not legally required, or has not been ruled to be legally required, at least by the courts here close to Washington, where I am. But this lawsuit that was filed earlier today tries to make the case that it should be legally required, not only for the White House, but for Mar-a-Lago, for Trump Tower, where Trump has sometimes held meetings in the past, and even perhaps for some of the other off-site places where he holds meetings, like his golf club in New Jersey.
So, and the suit is from the watchdog group in Washington, acronym for which is CREW.
It's from, yeah, several different groups, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, which had been the one that actually was in litigation with the Bush White House and then the Obama White House. You also have involved the National Security Archive, which is a group that does sort of national security-based reporting off of documents they obtain through the government under FOIA, someone who works for that group, and then also a fairly new group, a Knight Foundation First Amendment Center in New York, have all joined together in this suit, which they filed in New York, which normally wouldn't be terribly important, but I mentioned that there was litigation on this point a few years ago, and that was done in Washington, and by filing in New York, they may get a fresh look at this case in a way that they wouldn't have if they brought the suit in Washington, D.C.
Well, we know from Trump Tower that some of the visitors were snuck in the back door, were they not? The Russian ambassador being one of them. So
we know we didn't see them. I mean, the media was staked out there most of the day, most days, with a TV camera in the lobby. And I think you can go on C-SPAN if you wish, if you are sort of a masochist, and watch 8 or 9 hours of the elevator doors opening and closing at Trump Tower on days during the transition. But you're quite right. There were a number of visitors at different times that somehow made it into the building, I don't know, through the garage or a back door or some other entrance, without being spotted by the press pool.
And again, I'm speaking with Josh Gerstein, who is a senior White House reporter for Politico, specializing in legal and national security issues. Previously, he was a reporter for the New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News, and part of CNN's investigative unit. He has an article at Politico, New Suit Demands Trump White House Visitor Logs. So it sounds like with the National Security Archives and others, there doesn't seem to be a political motive. It's just transparency. But I guess the concern here is that at least the appearance of cronyism at a pretty high level, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's almost like, you know, Game of Thrones meets the Billionaires Club. It's the idea that the administration that's talking about draining the swamp, the most privileged people in America could afford $200,000 to join this club, can actually rub shoulders with the president and engage him in a chat and perhaps do a little bit of business. What's your sense of how this is playing in terms of the base of his support, who he ran as a populist?
You know, I don't know. It certainly outrages some people. How it plays with the base of his support, I think, is harder to know. There is a degree to which he makes the case, and it's not without some validity, that the people who voted for him were very aware that he was wealthy and hobnobbed in very wealthy circles. He, I think, throughout the campaign said that he was planning to bring some of his billionaire friends in to fix various problems across the government. If you see this as just an amplification and a fulfillment of those kinds of statements that he made during the campaign, I would imagine that many of his backers and many of the folks who voted for him are not troubled. You know, that there are some people who want to see his tax returns. There are others who don't care. The White House is clearly banking on the fact that those who don't care are greater in number or greater in significance for whatever reason. But as I said, it's a pretty unique situation to have this kind of situation with the private club and so forth. For years, presidents of both parties have gone to fundraisers with very well-heeled donors. Back during the soft money era, you had millions and millions of dollars being donated to parties and presidents showing up at those events. That you then had the Federal Election Commission conclude in the, I think, about 4 to 8 years ago, that it was fine for presidential candidates to show up at these dark money fundraisers for the super PACs, if you will, where millions of dollars were taken from folks. And so I think you could see it all of one measure or another there. Now, I don't know if people have actually signed up to belong to Mar-a-Lago to hang out with Trump. I'm sure some people will do that. But for the moment, it does seem to just, you know, reaffirm the clubbiness of his administration and of the circles from which he gets a lot of his advice.
But comparing it to our other incidents of, obviously, we have money-driven politics and all politicians have to spend an inordinate amount of time sucking up to wealthy people. But it's pretty unusual to actually own the venue, to be able to sort of double dip, if you will. Not only do you get donations, but you also own the venue, whether it's the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. or Mar-a-Lago.
Right, he does. And so he is in a position to profit from that. I don't know how many slots they have open at Mar-a-Lago, and obviously he can benefit off the Trump Hotel. It's just not a situation that we have encountered before. You're quite right. Even when people were showing up at those fundraisers, they were really donating money to the cause. They were not putting money directly into the pocket of Barack Obama or directly into the pocket of George W. Bush. That is not traditionally the way these things have been done. When I hear about things like that, I think back to Abscam and you know, senators taking suitcases or briefcases filled with money from various folks on TV. So this is clearly something that is moving closer to that area than it is to traditional political fundraising. And so you do have a lot of groups like the ones we mentioned earlier dogging the administration on this issue, on the degree to which Trump has agreed to step back from his investments, from his holdings. And for the moment, he has not done that. He's pretty much said, well, I won't run them, but he continues to profit from them to the extent they're successful. So he has not gone the route that many ethics experts have counseled and tried to divest himself of these properties, which would be difficult to do, not impossible, but difficult given that so many of them are attached to his personal brand. They're not exactly the kinds of assets that you could sort of readily convert into someone else's ownership. You know, in many instances, the properties aren't even his properties. It is solely his brand that's connected to some of these ventures of, you know, apartment buildings, condo buildings, office buildings overseas that have the Trump name attached to them. He's often just a beneficiary of those and not actually an owner of the property.
But he is, in this case, in terms of the lawsuit, to find out from the visitor's log who was visiting Mar-a-Lago and Trump Tower. They're both owned by him, I think, at least.
They are owned by him, but the lawsuit is really focused on the Secret Service. You know, the White House is not subject to the Freedom of Information Act, and that earlier ruling that I mentioned out of Washington, D.C., said that, written, by the way, by Merrick Garland, who somebody people may have heard of, said that you could not go through the Secret Service to sort of make an end run to get records of who's visiting the president. And so that's going to be the main obstacle for this lawsuit. That precedent is pretty clearly on point. But you can't go to the White House for records while a president's in office, and they won't allow you to go through the Secret Service. This is going to be another attempt to try to do that, to try to get the Secret Service to disclose who those visitors are. Who knows, maybe even set up conflicting rulings from the Second Circuit, which is New York, and the D.C. Circuit, and see if that dispute could maybe even make it to the Supreme Court. It's a little speculative at this point. There's several layers of litigation for this to go through before we'd be at that point.
Right, but there is a pretty fundamental difference. The White House is certainly not private property, but it didn't it sort of come up, in a sense, with Sean Spicer recently over the peculiar antics of Devin Nunes, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, who made these trips to the White House to and fro, allegedly to get intelligence or deliver intelligence, but it turns out he actually was given intelligence, which he then re-delivered, if you will, back to the White House. And I recall a lot of the reporters were basically saying, well, you know, Sean Spicer was saying, I don't know anything about it. And they kept saying, well, wouldn't the visitor's logs tell you in about 10 seconds exactly who showed up? So it does sound like it's an important issue, isn't it?
Sure. And you know, this was an established process under the Obama administration. Many of us who have occasion to go to the White House because of our reporting duties know how the system works. And there's a system at the White House where all the visitors, I say all, but nearly all the visitors who come in and out are logged in and often logged out. And they keep records on who invited them and what time they were supposed to come in and what time they actually arrived and when they departed. And that all became part of this log that was made public on a rolling basis by the Obama administration. I don't know any parallel process that is in place or has ever been in place for facilities outside the White House that the president might attend, even if a president, is at a fundraising dinner or something along those lines. It's just not my experience that everybody that he comes into contact with on a daily basis is logged by the Secret Service. And so I guess one of the things they're going to try to do through this suit is try to press for a greater disclosure of that. But if the Secret Service isn't taking in the information, then I don't think the Freedom of Information Act is going to be a good vehicle to try to force that. There are senators, of course, and members of Congress who have proposed legislation that would make it mandatory to record that kind of information. But, you know, I think folks can probably guess what the prospects of that legislation is under, with Republican control of both the House and the Senate.
Well, it's a little unusual, at least in the recent history of what happened at Mar-a-Lago, for David Koch to be there, given that the last time he was there in December, he was with a golf foursome, and one of the people in David Koch's team, I don't know what you call it on a golf course, but one of the four was Harry Hunt III, a biographer of Trump who Trump didn't like. And Trump found out that he was there, even though he's with the very powerful Koch brothers. He had them basically told his people to evict Harry Hurt III. And David Koch decided to go along with his partner who was being evicted. So I assume that hasn't left any lasting distaste in terms of David Koch, who showed up to have dinner with his brother, who I believe there is isn't there some kind of strange Game of Thrones backstory there with how William Koch, I think he's the oldest, the two other brothers conspired against him. They threatened to out him for being gay and essentially either stole his fortune or at least was able to grab a chunk of his fortune or at least grab control of Koch Industries. So can you elaborate on any of that?
Well, I know that there have over the years been disagreements among those Koch brothers, and I know that I think Bill Koch has traditionally been the one who's been friendlier towards Trump. There were periods during the campaign where
the other Koch brothers were, I think, aligned with Ted Cruz and were pouring money into his campaign, even at the point where, I shouldn't say into his campaign, but into super PACs affiliated with his candidacy. And so there was some ill will, certainly, between the Trump camp and many of those in the Koch world for some time. But there seems to be at least some effort to patch this over. And look, they are now in the position of trying to run rather large business enterprises in a country whose president is Donald Trump. And so as business people, I would think they would probably show a fair amount of flexibility. But I don't know enough about the inner workings of the Koch family to tell you how the brothers may or may not have patched up any past conflicts. It sounds like that they're out golfing and dining on a regular enough basis that they seem to have been able to come to some terms.
Well, clearly, William Koch supported Marco Rubio, did he not, in the primary, but then ended up supporting Trump, at least voting for him in the general election.
Right.
But I think, was it David Koch that was at Trump Tower for the election night victory celebration, along with Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley billionaire?
It may well be. I don't remember that directly, but I know that Peter Thiel is tight with those brothers, so Charles and David, and so I that's quite possible. I can't tell you off the top of my head.
Right, right. Well, they do have a libertarian ideology that they share in common.
Right.
And one of them, I think, one of the Koch brothers was a vice president of the Libertarian Party back in the 80s, was he not? He ran for president as a vice president of the Libertarian
Party. And so, yeah, they come from that viewpoint, and I think they have contributed to causes in parallel for many, many years. And so I know that, like you mentioned, Peter Thiel, who is tight with Trump but doesn't, I think, have a formal position in the administration, is also probably serves as some kind of a go-between them.
Well, Josh Gerstein, I thank you for joining us and for filling us in on how the how folks other than you or I live a rather plush existence.
Right. I let my Mar-a-Lago membership lapse a few years ago, and it's to my perennial regret.
I'm heartbroken to hear that. And I thank you for joining us.
Okay. My pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Josh Gerstein, who's a senior White House reporter for Politico. He specializes in legal and national security issues. Previously, he was a reporter at the New York Sun, Beijing correspondent for ABC News and part of CNN's investigative unit. And he has an article at Politico, "New Suit Demands Trump White House Visitor Logs." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.